the future is undefeated. Like, this is coming. I would just say that it's really easy to look at like the shiny object in front of you. But the idea is like, if the shiny object's going to work, which I think we all think it is, it means there's going to be like a bunch more companies that we're not thinking about right now that are going to benefit and emerge from this.
Welcome to The Angle from T. Rowe Price, a podcast for curious investors. Just a reminder that outside of the U.S. and Australia, this podcast is for investment professionals only. I'm your host, Jennifer Martin, a global equity portfolio specialist at T. Rowe Price Associates here in Baltimore, Maryland. In the final episode of this season on artificial intelligence, we're exploring AI's hidden winners, or what we like to call AI sleepers. So much of today's narrative is dominated by a handful of market leaders, but the opportunity extends far beyond them. So where might these sleepers be, and how do we identify them? Joining me today are Sean Curry, a portfolio manager in our small cap growth equities, and John Fryer, a portfolio manager in our large cap growth equities. Welcome to the podcast, Sean and John.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Well, let's start with what do we mean by AI sleepers? Sean, why don't you start?
So I guess how I think about it is there's a lot of talk about the AI cycle that we're in. And I don't really think about it as an AI cycle. I think about this as the data center cycle, right? There's a lot of capital being spent on building out the infrastructure of artificial intelligence. And the AI cycle itself will probably last decades. And the question, like, I think we're all trying to figure out now is how long does the cycle of investing the majority of CapEx in data centers last? So, I don't want to compare this too much to the internet cycle, but that was the last major hardware cycle that we saw. And we saw we had, a 5-7 year investment cycle in that. But what happened for the next 20 years after that is we had multiple other cycles, right? Building out fiber created the e-commerce cycle. It created the mobile phone cycle. It created the cloud cycle, which created the software as a service cycle. So when we think of AI sleepers, I just think of like, what are the next cycles we're going to talk about after the investment we're making in data centers?
Sean, that's so prescient, because I don't think anyone would have anticipated coming out of the tech and telecom boom, all the cool technologies that we got to use, like the iPhone, the different apps, Netflix. There's a lot of really interesting things that kind of came because of that infrastructure build out. So, John, maybe you want to add a little bit to that context of what an AI sleeper means for you and your asset class.
Yeah, I mean, if I think about this kind of sleepers analogy, and I take it a little broader, I mean, the market seems wide awake to the idea of the hardware cycle. Every day we talk about, big themes around chips and memory and optical and all of these components that we know very well at this point, and the stocks are up and the revenue is being recognized, and we can project out where this $1 trillion of CapEx is going, who's spending it, what they're spending it on, who's receiving these revenues. And the sleepers are the people that are a little bit behind that. So they're maybe building an application or a product, right? They really took advantage of the coding jump that came over the last 6 to 9 months. And they're using all of these new tools to actually build something that may not yet be in market. They're in different parts of the ecosystem than just pure hardware. They're not in a bottleneck story. And for most of them, we think of them as sleeping for a good reason. They haven't yet recognized revenue. They haven't shown the product. They're not accelerating their business because of the application of AI. But I do think we know a lot as a market and as a group of investors about that first category of sort of the wide awake stocks. And we know a lot less about the sleepers. And I think when we make a lot of money as investors, when we have real success, it's because we find something that the market doesn't quite know yet, and we try and invest ahead of it. And that's what I think about when I think about a sleeper stock.
Well, I think you're proving the point that I've heard many times. To be good at this job, you have to have an imagination, which it sounds like you're thinking about in that sleeper category. I think what's notable is you both look at opposite ends of the market spectrum, Sean in small caps and John in large caps. And I immediately go to David and Goliath in that analogy. So why are AI sleepers relevant now in your part of the market? And why do you think investors are really underappreciating them?
I mean, I think they're relevant in every part of the market, right? If we think about how much money that we're spending on the AI hardware cycle. If there is not a productivity increase, a cost decrease, new companies that emerge of this, like the technology will not have worked. And I don't think that is going to be the case. If you think about it, there's a lot of studies out there. We're going to spend, trillions of dollars on this. And people think that companies are going to spend $2 trillion a year on the services that these AI providers provide. right? If they're going to spend $2 trillion, they're going to have to get a benefit from it. So that's like some number that's bigger than that annually. And if you look at small caps, they tend to have lower margins, they're less efficient, they can move faster. If you look at the spend necessary to get productivity increases in AI, it's not a very large number. There's not a scale advantage to spending on this. So I just view it like small cap companies are going to probably get more than their fair share of the benefit of this. And on top of that, like every other technology cycle we've ever had, we're going to make this investment and all these new companies are going to emerge out of it, right? And the job is to find that like next generation of great companies, whether it's public markets, private markets, and you're starting to see these companies emerge. And I think like John said, we're just spending a lot of time talking about hardware, and justifiably so, right? But the next phase of this is like, if we're making all this investment, all these other companies are going to have to benefit too. And that's the area we're not spending a lot of time on yet.
Sean and I have worked together either as analysts or worked next to each other as portfolio managers for over a decade. And one of the reasons I love working with Sean and I was excited to do this podcast is I think we both really like looking at stocks. And if you really like looking at a whole bunch of different stocks and really getting into the details of them, sometimes the most obvious thing isn't actually the most interesting thing to look at. And so when I think about like what we're really trying to sort of find inside of these different areas and pockets of the market, are these things that maybe we haven't quite gotten to as a full market yet. So you take a number like $1 trillion of CapEx spend, or someday $1 trillion of revenue for some of these key frontier models. And you think about how many dollars that is for some part of the ecosystem to spend. And you realize, well, you know what? Maybe there's actually a pocket of the market that will work on the efficiency of how that $1 trillion is spent. And that pocket is actually not yet fully priced. So I can go find maybe a small stock that's been overlooked. Maybe it's in the software space. Maybe it's in the hardware space. Maybe it's something else. But they just work on taking that $1 trillion of spend down to $900 billion. That's actually a massive outcome. That's $100 billion of savings, and that might be an incredible small, mid, or even large cap stock. So we're trying to find those little things that kind of pop up inside of this giant wave that aren't yet fully priced.
Yeah, think about it. I mean, we spend a lot of time on the application layer of what will come in AI. Right. So one of them is robotics. And like, you know, what hopefully happens is that AI enables these robots. That means we use more of them. The price of the robots goes down. It's a self-fulfilling flywheel. But when you really like dive through it, programming a robot today costs more than building a robot. And if you program a robot, it's usually good at one task, like one discrete task. So it's not super useful at this point. AI is the unlock, right? So once it makes programming cheaper, it makes the ability for these robots to do multiple tasks. It makes the return on buying a robot better, which like then creates that self-enforcing flywheel. And we're trying to just think through in the small cap space, what do we always want to do that we couldn't do, and AI is going to enable us to do it? Like those are where like the big outcomes are going to be in the application layer. So like robotics is a good one. We're spending a lot of time on. I think about stuff in biology, right? Like all the frontier models are making significant bets on biology. So who has to benefit from that, right? I think what you're seeing right now is that we're making material gains in models through reinforcement learning. It's probably like a little different than we would have talked about 12 months ago. Reinforcement learning takes a ton of data, right? So we spent a lot of time on basically data providers inside like the biology complex. And if you think about like that, there's almost like an asymmetric risk reward to this, right? If you buy an AI hardware company, you are making a bet basically today that is sustainable, for there's duration to that bet. You're probably making the same bet with an AI biology data company, but you haven't had this like big massive run or these big earnings estimate revisions. So like your downside is less. So you're basically making the same bet with both of them because Anthropic and OpenAI are making that bet. But you probably have less downside in that. And you probably have more upside if it actually comes through. I just think that it's just worth more of our time to spend the application layer today. So we still spend time on that hardware cycle too.
For every bet, there's conviction and there's magnitude. I can have a lot of conviction that we're going to use a whole lot of logic chips, right? A lot of semiconductors, no matter what, into the future. The magnitude of me being right is an interesting debate, but we're certainly embedding a lot of magnitude already. We have a lot of expectation in those stocks. I'm not exactly certain where we're going to go. I have a lot of hope for it. We've done a tremendous amount of work to figure out where, but the magnitude, if we're right, is completely unpriced today. And that's really exciting.
And that's where alpha is. Alpha is in that change. And you know, I think you're both kind of highlighting. You're like a heat-seeking missile looking for that change in some of these opportunities.
I also think, I mean, AI is the most interesting thing that I've ever seen in my career. It's awesome to use. It's amazing what we could get out of this. But if we don't end up doing all this cool stuff, it wasn't worth it. So it's like very easy to bet on that these things are going to happen because the technology is improving. And if it's not, then we're just not going to talk about AI. And I just don't think that's going to be the ultimate outcome. I think we're going to have like real breakthroughs. So then just finding out where those breakthroughs are.
And that's probably a really good segue to what is the one common misconception about AI disruption?
I would always start by saying the first thing is that it's true, it's right, and it is very large. I've done this for about 16 years now. I am as bullish as I can possibly be about the future of AI and how it's going to be used. It has changed my personal experience of sort of being an investor more than any tool that I've been given over the last 16 years. And I expect that's only going to get better. I think sometimes when people give you this misconception question, you want to kind of quickly be contrarian. And I think the baseline is actually this is going to be a wonderful technology for a whole lot of people. I would say the piece that I am most skeptical about is that industry structure often is the most important thing to long-term returns. And I often find that when we get a whole lot more capital flowing very, very quickly into a given industry, returns go down. And right now, for the most part, what we are doing is saying that for some very traditional hardware industries, returns are going to go up and remain up for a very long period of time. And that hasn't actually been, if you believe in sort of this long-term returns on invested capital framework, big inflows of capital don't typically create higher returns over time. So that's like the one space where I would say I feel this very strong kind of push-pull versus my historical experience and really a historical experience that goes way before me and kind of what we're actually discounting in the market today.
I would say, I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of disruption, right? This is a profound technology. And it's much different, and how you use it is much different. The skill sets you need to have to succeed with it are much different. It's a very design-oriented technology, which lends itself to that there is going to be broad-based disruption as a result of it. There are going to be companies who you don't think about now who embrace this technology, and it just puts them ahead of all their peers, even if they aren't today. I would say, I feel like the market in these areas, say like software, where disruption risk is high, right? All these companies have become bucketed. Like you have certain attributes. So if you, if you have vertical expertise or you're embedded or you have some regulatory moat, that you're going to be okay relative to somebody else. And valuations like clearly show that there's a bucket of extremely cheap stocks. And there's a bucket of like, okay, stocks. And probably if you just thought about it like a basket, that's probably right. But the reality is like what's really going to matter is like, do you have a management team and a culture that is willing to disrupt your own business model to embrace AI and become tech enabled, right? There's a lot of companies, like look at the software cycle, right? A lot of the companies that I covered, they were, I covered payroll software. They were regional service bureaus. Some of them decided to embrace software as a service and make it their business model. Some didn't. The ones that went public were a handful of hundreds of these things. That's going to happen here too. So not necessarily because you don't have like the right attributes doesn't mean you're not going to succeed. And just because you have the right attributes doesn't mean you are going to succeed. It's the ones who are going to like actually embrace this and be willing to disrupt their own business model to do it. So I don't think it's like as straightforward as the market is trying to delineate it.
And I want to go back to something that you said, and I think you've said this in prior conversations with clients about how AI maybe doesn't, you said AI doesn't have a scale advantage, it benefits smaller companies. So maybe you could expand on that because I think it's a really interesting insight because I think we always think of large and scaled businesses as the ones that deserve to win.
Yeah, I just think, if you looked at like all the companies that are public and how much money they're spending, there are handfuls that are spending materially more money than everybody else. But besides that, we're talking about if you're spending $20 million this year on AI, or like that's your token budget across an organization, you're probably in the top two deciles of spend, right? Any public company can spend that if they so choose to. Token costs are going to go down over time. So I don't see like a real like cost advantage to scale. You know, smaller companies have less bureaucracy. They're able to move faster. A lot of them, you know, they kind of know they're not the winner. So it's actually easier to move on this because they're like, this is the only chance to become the winner. So I don't see a lot of like big advantages. I mean, John will probably have good answers in large cap. But so I don't see that. And you see that almost over every technology cycle, that companies use this moment as an opportunity to change the outcome of their business. That happens every single time. It's going to happen this time. Like, it's our job to find those companies. I do think that this cycle might lend itself a little bit more to those kind of companies than maybe the previous ones.
I mean, I love that. I fully agree on the scale piece. And you think of all the sort of Munger type quotes on how valuable scale is, and this feels different. I'd add sort of two observations. The first one is, when we think about sleepers in the large cap space, one thing that we are constantly trying to sort of guard against are some of these really large scaled companies that did something which I think is somewhat cynical, but the world sort of rewarded them for. So let's say they were a 6% grower or an 8% grower, and they would do a deal into a space that gave them slightly more accretive growth. But the quality of that business, like the truly differentiating moats, were actually lower. And they ended up with a number of things that I actually feel much worse about in the AI world. And they have piled on enough of these sort of small deals. And those are actually the businesses that I am the most worried about. So you actually have scale potentially as this sort of real disadvantage, because what scale did was it gave you a capital allocation benefit and you used it in a way that maybe wasn't in your core business or isn't going to help you in sort of this next generation of technology. So we're very careful about what I call sort of these, maybe a generation of cynical capital allocation that happened in the kind of a low interest rate world. The other thing I would observe, maybe in a different direction about scale, is that if you look at the history of the frontier model companies, the models were getting better the whole time. And one place where we really see scale matter, I think a lot, everyone's talked about how much better the big training run is, or a big, you know, post-training run. And what I would say is the whole time the models got better, that was somewhat predictable. What was not predictable was when or who exactly hit product market fit. And so when you actually had a chatbot sort of interface and that created this really tight product market fit with the consumer, you had just shockingly explosive growth and tremendous scale emerge. I would say the same thing happened with coding. It was not intuitive in the fall of last year that coding was going to have this level of product market fit once we put a proper harness around it. So what I would say is I agree on all parts of scale. But I also want to be humble enough that if we see product market fit emerge in the AI world, I think you can get to shocking levels of scale very, very quickly.
So just one thing that you said on that, every single technology cycle, you've had these companies where scale has been a disadvantage, right? Okay, so we have the internet cycle, then we go to e-commerce. It was not an advantage to be Macy's and JCPenney's and have a lot of malls, right? You could go faster if you didn't have that legacy infrastructure you were going to have to disrupt. If you went to the software cycle, right? All of a sudden you had this legacy tech debt where like a company could have five people in a garage and build a company out of it.
Don't forget the dog.
But I had companies like that. It was actually like an advantage that they weren't on COBOL, right? That's going to happen here too.
100%.
One final thing on scale, John, for you is, you know, some of your peers internally have said, you know, these large cap companies have a scale advantage because of their data. You know, they can train their own data, they can monetize it better, they have more looks. You know, how do you balance that with kind of your product market fit discussion?
So I think it's a wonderful point. What I have often found, and I covered a lot of the data names, and when I ran a sector team, it was, and often, a company has, let's just imagine, 100 units of data. And the data that's really special is maybe 10 units or 5 units. And this gets back to sort of that earlier point of, was there something cynical where you added a whole lot of data that's actually not that high quality? And what I have seen is, in a world with more and more synthetic data, the really, really special data is more rare than people think. And the most commoditized data is extremely available. The price of it is going down. And it's actually doing a lot of the work you need to get to where you would like to end up. Now, there are companies actively out there every single day producing more and more of this data. It's going to get very, very specific, very, very verticalized. But if that is your primary moat, I am curious about how it's going to work over a 3 to 5 year period, but confident that it will work over a 1 year period.
That is a great insight. It looks like you might want to add something.
No, sure? Okay. I think that's like completely right. I think John's all over that. I don't know. So what we do is like, what companies do we think are going to benefit from this? Like, where is data actually going to be important? I think if you're a company in a vertical and you have distribution that the model companies don't have, and you're able to like get data from that distribution, if you have data that the model companies don't have as well, I mean, and you understand your workflows, right? We're all trying to build data because we're trying to get the models to do things. If you understand your workflows, you can do that. And that you have some cost savings initiative inside your company where if anything happens with AI or spending, you can spend through it because you're getting a return on it. I think you're going to be in an okay spot.
So maybe the next question we should ask is, when you're evaluating a potential AI sleeper, what are the key characteristics you are looking for?
So for me, I really want to see evidence of a great technical team, ideally all the way up through management, not just at the level of sort of the engineering team.
So the CEO has to be AI enabled now?
Well, AI enabled and ideally, right, not just a salesperson. I like people that really have a product level experience. Maybe they are actually someone who grew up coding. This is someone in the organization who fully understands and is actually personally excited about this technology and in it close enough to sort of see where it's going and what it can do. So I actually care probably more, and I wouldn't have said this 3 to 5 years ago, about that management team's like real true capability inside of tech and deep tech. After that, it's a lot more diverse. So this may be, hey, things that we've always liked, right? Network effects, you know? Network effects may be something very close to collaboration. You see this in a bunch of different products, and you can even see this pretty clearly in the roadmap of the frontier model companies where they want to create more and more internal collaboration as it holds you more tightly. And I don't think it's all just sort of optimizing for a monetization or a business outcome. I think it's actually, you know, from the frontier model perspective, it's actually really good for us as enterprises to be able to collaborate. I want to be able to share my models and my concepts with Sean. I want him to be able to share them back and do it in the same sort of model environment. The other one I would consider is anything that has some sort of like physical component. And I think this matters most just because it slows down the rate at which someone can disrupt you. If you have physical sensors, if you have a real logistics network, if you have something that sort of binds you to the physical world and will be difficult to get scale in and to replace, that is a place where I actually do believe scale still matters and where you're really going to have a long time to get your business oriented around whatever is coming with AI. I'd highlight probably those, yeah.
I think those were perfect. Those are how we think about it too, right?
That's a really good clarification on, you know, some of the characteristics that you're looking for and some of the durability. And I think it's a really good distinction that the physical world still does create some barriers to those AI-enabled companies. I guess as we're thinking about AI, I know our audience is always really interested in how our own internal investment staff is including AI into your process. And so I know both of you do you guys have wizard hats? Or, you know, there's the AI wizards group. Where do you feel like you fall in that spectrum? But I think maybe the audience would be love to hear about your AI process, what you're doing. I know, Sean, you've been doing a lot of cool stuff in small cap.
I never got a hat.
All so right, well, I'll have to find out the guy and hand some out.
What we're doing is the same thing that like John just talked about with management teams, right? Like, just think about like what AI does at a high level. We are amplifying the design layer and we are commoditizing the productivity layer. That's basically what we're doing. So how do we think about that like in our job, right? Like where we really drive alpha as an organization is that we have these really great analysts who like truly are domain experts who understand their businesses. And it's not like, honestly, it's not like the exact earnings estimates. It's not what they think about an earnings call. It's that they like truly understand what matters, right? So if you have people like that, you can use AI to amplify that. So that's really like what we spent a lot of time on. Now, yeah, there's a lot of productivity that we've done, right? I can get an initiation about any company in the, you know, Russell 2500 in 5 minutes, right? I can go through my own framework on a company. Those are really just like screening tools, effectively, at scale. But when an analyst like knows its industry and knows like the two to three things that matter, we can actually design like almost any kind of analysis now around those things. And that's how we get a true insight over a multi-year period. So we've been just trying to use it to, when I was an analyst, when John was an analyst, like you would try to do these analyses, like, I don't know, like an industry model, right? And get some insights out of it. It would take, I don't know, the one I built, it took me probably like 3 months to do it. I mean, you can do it in like 6 hours now, maybe, probably faster, but like maybe if you really want it, like exactly how you want it. So you're just able to do a lot more of like the cool stuff faster than you have more time to do.
I mean, I feel like I've been sort of following that same journey as probably most people. So, you know, the beginning was a lot of chat, and the chat would look like deep research, and it would be some sort of question about historicals or something analytical. You know, in the last 6 to 9 months, all of a sudden the ability to like quickly build out an Excel template or to use my existing Excel templates and you know, generate kind of incremental updates to them using the frontier models has been so much better. My favorite thing over the last 6 months has been these industry models, which they were labor intensive and you were pulling data from all over and it was, you know, very analyst. And now you ask it to sort of run overnight and what you wake up with in the morning is just like exquisite.
Magical.
Yeah. But for all of that, like I always think of trying to describe the strategy. It's like, what are we trying to do? Like we are trying to find insights from this incredible analyst platform that we have at T. Rowe Price. Something where some industry expert who's an analyst here has found out some unique piece of data insight analysis that's not in the rest of the world. And it's often very hard for me to tell what our analysts know that the rest of the world doesn't. And we have built out a very large platform internally using AI so that we can examine the sell side, the internet broadly, expert networks, compare all of that content to what our own analysts are writing and help me find and really tell what are the most unique insights that are coming from this platform so that I can be actively invested behind those specific ideas. And it has made that job much, much easier. And that's something we've really kind of rolled out over like the last 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, this is like the funnest time I've ever had doing this job, right? If you, I mean, you do this job because you're intellectually curious, that you want to learn about things, that you want to uncover something that people aren't thinking about. And now you can do it at scale. It's, I mean, it's awesome. It's the most fun I've ever had doing this job.
Every PM that we've had on this podcast has basically said their job is so much more fun. It's much more joyful. And I think what both of you highlighted is the importance of an investment framework. It allows you to be repeatable. You can get through a lot of tasks in a very, I would say, standardized manner. And it makes you, with those insights, difficult to imitate. You know, that's where your alpha is. I think that's really, really cool. And you made a lot of directors of research happy by talking about our analysts. So thank you.
they deserve that.
We do have some really good subject matter experts. So I think the final question is thinking about, you know, if our listeners remember just one thing from today's discussion, what would you want it to be?
I feel like we just had a discussion and it almost made it sound like what we're in right now and this AI investment is maybe not as important. I don't want it to be like that, right? Like this is the most profound thing that has happened in my entire career, right? And you asked the question on disruption. I mean, there's gonna be a ton of disruption, right? The future is undefeated. Like this is coming. I would just say that it's really easy to look at like the shiny object in front of you. But the idea is like, if the shiny object's gonna work, which I think we all think it is, it means there's gonna be like a bunch more companies that we're not thinking about right now that are gonna benefit and emerge from this. And I think where you're gonna really make money over the next 5 to 10 years is finding those companies.
I couldn't agree more. And I would start with this core principle of there's going to be so much more AI in the world. And then I always wanna match that with just as much humility about how hard it is to predict the exact magnitude and the exact timing via a lens of risk reward for that specific trend. And one of the reasons why Sean and I are looking for those sleepers is because we just want to twist the odds a little bit in our favor, where we think we can be a little more certain about that risk reward since we're not already paying for the magnitude and the timing. That's what I like doing. I was excited to talk about it. And I think there's actually a lot of opportunity for that at this specific moment.
That is perfect. I mean, I think you both did a very good job today explaining how transformational this technology is, how you both have to manage the existing cycle responsibly. You know, there's a lot of excitement still in chips and the physical enablers of AI. But your job also is to be really curious and kind of think about the undetermined future and maybe what those next gen winners will be, as we call them, sleepers. So let's stop there, Sean and John. This has been really a great discussion, and we really appreciate your time on behalf of the audience. Thank you.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Again, I'm Jennifer Martin. Thank you for listening to The Angle. We look forward to your company on future episodes. You can find more information about this and other topics on our website. Please rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The Angle, better questions, better insights, only from T. Rowe Price.
This podcast episode was recorded in August of 2026 and is for general information and educational purposes only. Outside of the United States and Australia, it is for investment professional use only. It is not intended to be used by persons in jurisdictions which prohibit or restrict distribution of the material herein. This podcast does not give advice or recommendation of any nature or constitute an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any security in any jurisdiction. Prospective investors should seek independent legal, financial, and tax advice before making any investment decision. Past performance is not a guarantee or a reliable indicator of future performance. Technology companies may be more vulnerable and can be affected by intense competition, regulation, earnings disappointments, and rapid product obsolescence. Discussions relating to specific securities are for informational purposes only and do not represent recommendations and may or may not have been held in any T. Rowe Price portfolio. There should be no assumptions that the securities were or will be profitable. T. Rowe Price is not affiliated with any companies discussed. All investments are subject to risk, including the possible loss of principal. The views contained herein, including forecast and forward-looking statements, are those of the speakers as of the date of the recording and are subject to change without notice. These views may differ from those of other T. Rowe Price associates and or affiliates. Economic estimates and forward-looking statements are subject to numerous assumptions, risks, and uncertainties. Actual outcomes could differ materially from those anticipated in estimates and forward-looking statements. Forecasts are based on subjective estimates about market environments that may never occur. Information is from sources deemed reliable but not guaranteed or verified. Please visit http://www.troweprice.com/theanglepodcast for full global issuer disclosures. This podcast is copyright by T. Rowe Price 2026.